On this week's 51%, a woman hopes to help others caring for their aging parents.
If my mom were 50 and not 90, would she be given this kind of care? And the nurse took me aside and said, no.
A female activist works to keep youth from fleeing an African country, and an anthropologist tells us about a macho sport involving birds. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Ou alors seulement parfois, du bout des yeux, même riches, ils sont pauvres, ils n'ont plus d'illusions et n'ont qu'un cœur pour deux. Chez eux, ça sent le thym, le propre, la lavande.
Marcy Cottrell Houle, a wildlife biologist and award-winning author, has co-authored a book she initially had not planned on writing. It's called The Gift of Caring, Saving Our Parents from the Perils of Modern Healthcare, and Houle co-authored it with Dr. Elizabeth Ekstrom, director of geriatric medicine at Oregon Health and Sciences University. Houle talks about why she ended up writing the book, which is a blend of memoir and medical advice to help families navigate what she calls the confusing and fragmented healthcare delivery system for aging people.
I think it was important to share, and it was something I never thought about originally because being a writer, I've written other books. But this was something that I never really considered as a book, but I always kept journals. In fact, when my parents started getting sick, I was online to write another book and found, like I think a lot of people all find themselves as being caregivers, I didn't have the time or the focus. I had a young family, my dad who had been so active, and my mom started getting sick. And so not having the understanding what we were going through, it just really changed our lives quite a bit. And it was kind of a 14-year process of going through first my dad and then my mom's health care. And I think what was so disturbing to me was seeing the suffering that they went through. And I didn't have the lingo, the understanding, or knowing how to best advocate for them, and mostly felt like I was kind of an interference or a nuisance when I tried to advocate. I never used to worry about getting old at all because my dad was a doctor, an orthopedic surgeon, and he also was a very caring, wonderful man. He started at the Oregon Health and Sciences University something called the, was then called the Crippled Children's Division. He gave free treatment to children with cerebral palsy. He went to nursing homes to take care of people's feet. He was such a lovely man, plus he did everything right in terms of aging. He was canoeing the Yukon River in his 60s. He was jogging. He was doing everything. So, and they actually didn't have me till they were 40. So I saw these people I love getting old, and they just seemed vital. It's like, what did I have to worry about? Well, when my dad started getting Alzheimer's around 78, that first we were in denial, which I think a lot of people are. It's like, no, it has to be something else. So as we started living through that, the care that I thought would always be there for the people I loved because I'd seen them provide care wasn't. And then I came to realize the whole healthcare delivery system was fractured, it was confusing, it was broken, and it left us, and so many times, my parents suffering in ways I couldn't stand watching. And so I kept everything in my journals. I couldn't write books anymore, but taking care of our families and trying to be a caregiver to my parents, since I was the one daughter who lived in town, I just kept copious journals of these things that were so disturbing. And then later, after all was said and done, got together with a lovely geriatrician and decided this was information that needed to get out into the public, because the saddest thing to me was a lot of the things I saw my parents suffer and a lot of the things I think a lot of caregivers of aging parents see their parents suffer are not necessary. There's such a better way, and that language is only known among geriatrics, the medical community, is not being translated to the general public. So it's relieving, very specifically, lots of elderly people suffering in ways they don't have to. We know better. And interestingly, too, this is being recognized in the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA. It was a very interesting article by a doctor, Joanne Lind, and an issue called Critical Issues in U.S. Healthcare. And it says, discussions about living with frailty are virtually absent from popular media, from political discussion, and professional education. And that, recognizing that, and I wrote her, that people don't know, we don't talk about it, we want to deny it, we're in denial, and yet to me that's a real tragedy because it, we know more, geriatricians know more. The problem is there aren't going to be many geriatricians around.
How did you hook up with Dr. Ekstrom on this, though?
Well, that again is interesting, too, and I'll back up just a little bit with this. I think when you're a caregiver sometimes to aging parents, you worry with the effect you're going to have on your own family. And I certainly did because we had, when my dad started getting sick, our kids were like 3 and 5 years old. And for 14 years, we spent so many holidays, I think this is common, in the ER or in the hospital for their birthdays or for Christmas or in the nursing home for Thanksgiving. And where I saw a lot of my friends take their kids to Disneyland and different things, we couldn't. You know, we were kind of the ones on call. And I used to worry, am I ruining my kids by having everything a crisis with aging parents? But, you know, they loved my parents. They loved their grandparents. And it didn't ruin them. They both grew up to become doctors.
Oh, really?
Doctors with a heart, yes. And one thing that how this all happened was when my daughter Emily had just finished medical school at OHSU and was starting her residency in, at Seattle Children's, she said, you know, Mom, we were taking a walk together. She said, you should think of using all those journals and writing a book with Dr. Ekstrom. I said, well, who's that? She said, she was my teacher in geriatric medicine I had in medical school, and she's fantastic. She's so excited about aging. You would just love her. Why don't you ask her if you'd want to write a book together?
Hmm.
I said, well, why would she want to write a book with me? She said, well, just ask. So I did. And out of the blue, and she said, I'd love to meet with you. And then we met, and then I said, if you can give me 20 or 25 things that you as geriatrician know, but the general public doesn't know, but you'd love for them to know, I can craft a book around it, because I went through just about everything with my parents. And so we did. We did it together. And so it's a story, of course, of the caregiving experience of a family with every few chapters, What I Wish I'd Known, written by one of the nation's leading geriatricians that, to me, validated everything I went through. As an advocate that felt like I was failing, I wasn't wrong. You know, caregivers aren't wrong in what they're seeing, but we just don't have the lingo and we don't have the knowledge. And yet, if we do, and if we're armed with that, we can make a huge difference in the quality of life of our loved ones.
Well, sure, because nobody knows your loved one like you do.
Right.
And some of it, you know, you may not have the medical background or you may not have whatever, but you have, you know them, and you know when there's pain and you know when it's not an emergency or when it is, and, you know, or you know when to call someone to help make that call. You're not helpless, but there is such a helplessness about it. Right. But maybe you could share a few of, you know, they're all big, but maybe share a few you'd like to of the geriatrician and your writing here.
Right. Well, two things that I'd love to share that have not ever been written about or discussed again in the general population that geriatricians know. One is called something very important called polypharmacy. And polypharmacy is kind of defined as complications related to too many drugs that are given, and it's a major problem that affects 1 out of 2 senior citizens. And what's interesting, if medication problems were ranked as a disease, it would be the 4th leading cause of death in older adults. And anyway, physicians, geriatricians realize this, and the problem is most providers, without understanding the side effects of all these drugs, prescribe medications unknowingly that have the potential to harm older adults. They can cause a lot of symptoms such as dizziness and confusion and predispose patients to falling. Problem is, we look at that, providers look at that as just symptoms of old age, and they don't consider it's the drugs and the drug interactions. And what it happens is they're saying people over 70 are 7 times more likely than someone in their 20s to have adverse reactions to commonly prescribed drugs. And you might say, well, why? Well, as I learned, older people don't have the lean muscle mass. They have a smaller liver. They have reduced liver blood flow. Their kidneys don't work as well. They just can't process all of these drugs that are treating them. And so the American Geriatric Society has developed a list of drugs seniors should never be on but are routinely prescribed. problem is it's only been among the geriatric community. And that was one thing we wanted to get out in this book, is a 10-page appendices of every one of those drugs and trade and generic name and their side effects, so people can go to their doctors and say, why is my mom on Phenergan? Why is my dad on what such and such? Is there a safer alternative? Because it makes him dizzy and makes him confused. And that discussion needs to be heard. And secondly, I think that one main thing I learned, and that I would love to see a huge discussion with this nationwide, because it's going to affect all of us one day or another, is the importance of geriatricians. And what it, you know, we assume, I think, that pediatricians are going to take care of our kids or people who are trained in pediatrics, but geriatricians have so much specialized knowledge, and there's going to be fewer and fewer of them, even though they're saying in the next 15 years there's going to be 70 million people over 65. But there's only going to be one geriatrician for every 4,000 people. In 2012, only 100 doctors nationwide went into a fellowship of geriatrics. The reason is it's the lowest paying medical specialty. Young doctors, even if they wanted to go into it, couldn't pay off their loans. And so we have a big crisis ahead of us when we need geriatricians, because there again, research shows, and once my parents got under the care of geriatricians, it changed everything, their health care. Its research is showing it increases a senior's quality of life. They get more years of independent living, less time in a nursing home. And I think what we all want is this thing called, what they say, compressed morbidity, where you live well until your 90s, you have a short period of being sick and die. But that's not the way it is today. Under the healthcare delivery system, most people spend a lot of years or their last months in a nursing home. 70% use up all their life savings, and it's not a good way, a good ending. And the sad thing is it doesn't have to be that way. But if we don't have geriatricians leading the way, and it doesn't look like there will be, not only are our parents, but we will be facing not very happy endings. And as I say, the tragedy to me is we know how we could make it different.
Marcy, when you were keeping journals, was that your way of coping? Was it a coping mechanism for you? I know you're a writer, so it would make sense, the journals, but not foreseeing a book coming out of this at the time. Was that your way of dealing?
It was very much so. And you look at, and we talk about, I talk about this too, about how do you, as a caregiver, you go through so much that even though I think the sad thing is no matter what we're doing, the loved one we care for is going to die. And all the trying you try to save them from that end is not going to work. But if you can look at it as making it more comfortable and more interesting and more wonderful aging, then I think it reduces some of that pain. But that being said, it's still tiring and hard being a caregiver, and you have to look at ways to cope. And one we did, of course, was writing in journals. That helped a lot, especially when I felt so frustrated and alone seeing my parents suffer. And so I would write down the discussions I'd have with the providers that sometimes. There was one, for example, when my mom had delirium in the hospital. She was being written off, and I couldn't stand. She couldn't speak. She was like clawing at the air. I couldn't stand it. I was just in tears, wasn't getting anywhere. And I finally went up to a nurse, and I just said, if my mom were 50 and not 90, would she be given this kind of care? And the nurse took me aside and said, no. Those are the things I wrote in my journals. Those are the things where you realize an older person can be so marginalized. And I had to write those in there and then try to figure out ways, what could I do to try to stop this suffering? And as I say, once I got the geriatrician who informed me, what I had seen my mom go through was probably one of the worst things you can ever see. He validated it. But some of the other providers were like, oh, it's just dementia she has. It's like, it wasn't. It was what she acquired while in the hospital. And that's a very common problem, but I didn't have the lingo. I didn't know the word baseline. I didn't know the word HAD, hospital-associated disability. I didn't know the words activities of daily living. If I had known those words, I could have had care for her. And those are other things I want to get out there. Here is the medical lingo you need, and you need to insist upon to get the proper care.
Marcy, you give that example, too, about taking aside the nurse and saying, well, if she were 50, would this be happening and not 90? And I'm curious to know that in that same kind of context, did you find, since you cared for both of your parents, did you find that there was a gender bias?
Not necessarily. Perhaps there was more of a... The big bias I saw was symptoms being written off as just old age. When I knew, because with my dad, I did see Alzheimer's. I saw every step of that progression. My mom, when she would get a urinary tract infection and have to go to the hospital, would get temporary dementia. And that happens all the time when older people get infections from pneumonias, from urinary tract infections. What would be the problem was I didn't have the lingo to say, this is not her baseline. I would just try to say, she doesn't have dementia. And they'd say, she has Alzheimer's. It's like, she doesn't. But I would, you know, and so they thought I was the crazed daughter, like they see, and didn't know what I was talking about. But I did know what I was talking about. So I did not per se see any gender bias at all, but I did see a bias just to being old.
That was Marcy Cottrell-Houle, co-author with Dr. Elizabeth Ekstrom, of The Gift of Caring, Saving Our Parents from the Perils of Modern Healthcare. We switch gears and turn to a story about youth. Fanta Diallo believes that you do not need to travel thousands of miles to Europe to become successful. She's an activist who believes Africa is a land of opportunities and encourages young people to stay home in Senegal. We get the story from DW reporter Stefan Moll.
A place of opportunities. That's what Dakar is to Fanta Diallo. She believes there is a bright future for her country, and she wants to spread this confidence among her fellow citizens. That is why the 31-year-old founded Senegalese Dream, an organization that tries to convince young Africans hoping to find work in Europe to rather make Senegal their country of choice.
He's educated, unlike most young people in Senegal. But despite his education, he can't find a job. So what can you do? Emigrate? Lie down and sleep? Take on the whole world? No, you get up every morning and do what you can.
One such person is Fanta's neighbor, Buka, whom she helps to set up a coffee shop.
I put it all down on paper. I presented it to them, and they advised me to do this and not do that, that this would work out. They found a place for me.
Every month, thousands of young and educated Senegalese leave home to search for work abroad. Many risk their lives trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea by boat. According to the International Organization for Migration, between January and March this year alone, 1,200 Senegalese were among those who reached the shores of Italy. Senegalese Dream convinced Buka to stay, and it supported him in getting the official documentation and in drawing up a business plan. In schools all around the country, Fanta engages with the young generation. For her, entrepreneurship and agriculture are the answers to the job crisis. Even on weekends, scores of pupils come to listen to her.
People prefer sweeping the streets of Amsterdam, sweeping the streets of Berlin or Barcelona to working our own land because they think that is success. When they get back off the plane in Dakar, they wear fancy clothes, their cousins carry their luggage, and they go on to marry the best-looking girl in the family because they made it to Europe. After a month, they are back in Berlin sweeping the streets.
Fanta's life story is her best example. Coming from a modest background, her family wanted her to work in France. But she went to university instead and got a scholarship with the German Konrad Adenauer Foundation. Eventually, she became a deputy mayor in Dakar. For her, education is key.
Fanta is my role model. I want to be like her once I finish school.
Mamadou Maktar does not share Fanta's vision. Despite having an education, he could not find employment in Senegal for years. Disillusioned, the 35-year-old took a boat and tried to leave, but the Spanish Coast Guard stopped him. He says he will try again, for the sake of his young son.
I want a brighter future for him. I don't want him to live like me. I don't think I can fulfill my dreams by staying here.
These are the stories Fanta faces every day, but the flight to Europe helps neither the country nor its people.
That was Stefan Moll reporting for DW. And now some female insight into a male sport, but one you might not know about. The federal government recently closed an 8-year investigation into smuggling operations related to this unusual sport, a Virginia scholar studies bird sport, which came to the U.S. from Guyana, South America. Lilia Fukin reports.
Laura Mentor is a professor of anthropology at the University of Mary Washington, and she studies bird sport in Guyana.
It's a strange image to a Westerner, I think. These very sort of macho young men in their muscle t-shirts, out on their bicycles or riding the minibus. But at the same time, they've got this delicate little grip on these bird cages with songbirds in them.
Bird sporting events are not like gruesome cockfights, but more like American Idol.
They train these little chestnut-bellied seed finches, cute little brown birds. They're training them for basically a musical competition.
Mentor says it's natural that bird sport found its way to the U.S.
There are actually more Guyanese living in New York and London than there are in Guyana.
And when young men leave Guyana, they often take their birds with them.
And this has actually led to a few pretty high-profile news stories about Guyanese who are caught at the U.S. borders for trying to smuggle these little finches, sometimes inside plastic hair curlers, so they don't sing on the plane.
After intense training and grooming, the birds perform in singing duels.
Men will meet, say, on Sunday mornings in parks. They'll set on a pole two of these cages side by side. And so they're essentially putting two male territorial songbirds right next to each other. And there's a judge and usually a crowd of onlookers.
Perched in their own cages, the birds sing their little hearts out, and the first to complete the agreed-upon number of songs is declared the winner. Mentor says that in Guyana, bird sport can be a high-stakes game.
The men actually bet sometimes really considerable sums of money, which is interesting considering this is one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. And when you hear that, okay, men are wagering their motorcycle or a month's income on their songbird, you realize they're tremendously invested in this.
But Mentor discovered that bird sport is about something much deeper than just gambling.
These young men are seeking an alternative means of earning reputations in their society. You know, when you go to a bird sporting event, you'll see doctors, lawyers, bricklayers, bus drivers. They actually refer to these events as bird church, sort of signaling that this is a rare occasion when men of all these different socioeconomic backgrounds can come together and compete on equal terms.
Mentor says these birds are smuggled into the U.S. because the most valuable finches are those that were captured from the wilds of interior Guyana.
There's a direct relationship between the amount of passion with which a bird sings and the kind of landscape in which it was born and acquired those territorial singing capacities. So I think especially for Guyanese immigrants, to have a bird from that landscape, their own home environment, if you will, it gives this oral presence of their home country and the passion that's identified with being Guyanese.
The recently concluded investigation in bird trafficking resulted in multiple arrests and the confiscation of over 100 birds. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
And now something about female first. Two women have passed the Army's grueling ranger test, becoming the first females to complete the combat training program and earn the right to wear ranger tabs on their uniforms. The Army's Ranger Headquarters in Fort Benning, Georgia, says the women and 94 men passed the 62-day course that tests their ability to overcome fatigue, hunger, and stress during combat operations. Now, even tougher and more dangerous jobs could lie ahead. Senior officials tell the Associated Press the military is poised to allow women to serve in most frontline combat jobs, including Navy SEALs and the Army's Delta Force. And officials say the Army, Navy, and Air Force likely will not seek exceptions that close any jobs to women. Marine Corps leaders, they say, have expressed concerns about women in infantry jobs and yet may seek an exception. But that would likely meet resistance from senior officials. Even Special Operations Command is likely to allow women to compete for military commando jobs. The services must make their recommendations to Defense Secretary Ash Carter this fall. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1362.